Tomorrow on Issues Etc., here's a conversation I've been looking forward to for some time. It's the latest thing, it's the newest, it's the hippest, the emerging church movement. You may have simply heard about the emerging church. It's kind of church growth too, but it's a little more complex than that. We'll talk with Shane Rosenthal of the White Horse Inn about the emerging church movement. Then Dr. Martin Nolan will join us tomorrow on the program of the Concordia Historical Institute to talk about the office of the papacy. Now, we will make a distinction between the papal office and the man who occupies that office, but there is a question I will put to Dr. Nolan tomorrow and get his answer on this. Pope John Paul II is old and ailing, so let's say for the sake of argument, he doesn't make it through to 2006. The question on everyone's lips the day after the Pope dies is, will he be in heaven? We'll find out what Dr. Nolan's answer will be to that tomorrow on the program. Also, the conclusion of our four-part series on the book of Joshua. We're going to be talking about how the victories that God enabled Joshua and the armies of Israel to win enabled God to keep his promise that they would live in the land with rest from their enemies according to his covenant and his mercy and his promises. And we'll talk about that tomorrow with Dr. Adolf Harstadt, who's author of the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. It's the basis for this series as well. It's $42.99 plus shipping and handling. Why? Because it's a big commentary on this Old Testament book. It has something for everyone. It's at every level. If your pastor is a devotee of the biblical languages and likes to go as deep as you can possibly go into a biblical book, he can do it in this commentary, but you can also benefit from it. There is a very clever separation of the more erudite, more learned, more scholarly sections from those things that most of the rest of us would benefit from reading. You have access to the scholarship, but if you don't want to handle the Hebrew, you're not inclined to, or you're not able to, you can still get the best of the content out of this book in a very readable commentary on the book of Joshua. $42.99 plus shipping and handling. Call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or go to our website, scroll down on the homepage, and you'll find the image of and information about the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. Well, I'll give you the number one more time, 1-800-325-3040. And if you don't want to make a phone call or go online and you want to simply actually pay for it the old-fashioned way, go into one of the two locations that Concordia Publishing House has here in St. Louis. There are two bookstores, one at 3558 South Jefferson in the city, the other yards from where I'm sitting on the campus of Concordia Seminary here in St. Louis, 801 DeMunn. Follow the signs to the CPH bookstore. Ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua. Rita Marker is our guest. She was with us yesterday, but the story that we are talking about with her is unfolding as we speak. We're going to get an update on Terry Schindler Schiavo and the legal case that is still being mounted by her parents. Rita Marker is executive director of the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. Rita, welcome back.
Thank you.
Yesterday when we were talking, by way of a personal note, your husband had been rushed to the hospital. How's he doing?
He's doing fine. In fact, I've talked to him a number of times since then, and he sounds really, really good. My daughter is right there with him. I was going to go back a day early, and they said, no. The doctor said it's just a minor lung infection, and he'll be out tomorrow. So thank you for all of your interest and your prayers. I really appreciate it.
Well, and we are certainly thankful that you would be willing to join us not only yesterday when this was happening in your life, but also today as, you know, you're still out of town, and he's still in the hospital.
Yep, but been talking a lot on the phone.
Yeah, I'm sure you have. But that's what they're made for.
Yep, that's right.
At a time like that, the phone bills just don't matter anymore.
No.
Rita, what's the latest with Terry Schindler? And I heard at the top of the news that another 48 hours has been granted by Judge Greer.
Right. Now, you know, there's always the possibility of a change of heart for anyone. And I think that may be happening with Judge Greer in that a change of heart to look more closely at this. Several things are in the hopper right now. One being, I think, which is the most important thing, and that is the whole issue of whether Michael should be her guardian. And apparently the Florida Department of Children and Families has intervened, and they are looking into that. because there were some concerns that there may have been spousal abuse that actually led to Terry's injury, and that had never been investigated. And it looks as though there is some movement on the part of the Florida Department of Children and Family Services, which is has the mandate of protecting vulnerable people, people with disabilities. And so that's one thing that's happening. Another thing is that Judge Greer has said that he's willing to entertain arguments as to more tests being needed. And that really is based on what happened last week. If people recall, they may have heard of the young woman who had been considered to be in a coma for years and then started talking again. And looking at the videos of that young woman, she looked much less alert than Terry. And so I think Judge Greer is saying, wait a minute, maybe this isn't what he thought it was, and that there would be a reason for more tests and to go forward with that. Now, on the other side of that, of course, George Filos, Michael Schiavo's attorney, has said, but wait a minute, she was in a minimally conscious state, and then there were some studies that came out within the last few weeks about people recovering from severe brain damage, and they're saying, but those people were minimally conscious, and so that's not Terry's condition, and that she's far worse off. Well, in fact, it is what many people had referred to her as being when they thought that would push their agenda. So there are these sorts of developments. The one I think that is the most crucial is that he be removed as her, that Michael be removed as her guardian. But the stalemate, at least for now, has been broken with at least a ray of light that there's going to be more being done. I know that your listeners really want to do everything that they can, and a lot of people have said, well, you know, we're going to send Bush a letter saying he's not doing everything. I would say that would be the wrong way to go about it. Governor Bush is doing everything he can, and I think it would be important for people, yes, to send communications to him, but not to tell him he's not doing enough, but to thank him for doing everything he's doing and everything he will do, to support the fact that he is doing everything he can and is doing more than many people thought was possible to protect Terry.
A couple questions here raised by what you just told us. We'd had conversations with Wesley Smith on this months back, maybe years back. Mm-hmm. And he had raised the question about spousal abuse and about the nature of the initial injury
right.
that got Terry into the situation where there was medical malfeasance. And he said, I have no evidence of this, but some have wondered whether or not Michael might have had a hand in the initial problem, because it has remained mysterious why she collapsed, a perfectly healthy young woman.
Right. And if people recall, when her initial collapse occurred, Terry had been undergoing some medical examinations to find out why she had not become pregnant. And it was thought that part of the reason was that she had lost a huge amount of weight, over 100 pounds. She had been very, very heavy for a long time when she was growing up. And she had dieted severely, and so that could have led to her temporary infertility. So because she was under a doctor's treatment, then when she collapsed, the assumption was made, and that was the way that the malpractice case proceeded, being that, well, if someone has been dieting so extensively and lost so much weight so fast, it must have been a potassium imbalance, which the doctor should have caught. And that was what was in the malpractice case. That was the basis of a malpractice award, which went for Terry's care and then some of it for Michael for his loss of consortium. So that was always in the lore, and it was the jury's finding that was the reason for her injury. However, when Pat Anderson took over as attorney for the Schindlers in this case, she looked at some of the x-rays that had never been examined before, x-rays that were taken of Terry soon after she was admitted and soon after her injury. And those x-rays were also, I believe, examined by Dr. Michael Bodden. Now, people may have seen him on a number of television shows. He's one of the preeminent pathologists and determines causes of injuries of people. And he said that the types of injuries indicated by Terry's x-rays could only have come from two things. One would be just a severe car accident or something like that, a really bad trauma, or a severe beating. Well, she hadn't been in a car accident. The other thing was that co-workers of Terry's came forward then later and said that Terry had told him that she was planning to leave her husband because he was so jealous, so controlling, and that, in fact, he would do such things as write down the mileage on her car to see how far she had driven. And there seemed, and I can't say for certain, and we don't know, so we can't say that he did this, but there is the possibility, and one should investigate it, that this is kind of the way in which an abusive spouse acts, a controlling abusive spouse. In addition to that, Terry would show up at work with bruises and say, well, Michael just pinched her very hard. So all of these things may not indicate spousal abuse, but all of these things indicate that there should definitely have been, and if it hadn't been until now, and now it looks like there may be the possibility of, yes, looking at this again and saying, wait a minute, is it possible that the very person responsible for the condition Terry is in is the one that was named as her guardian?
That certainly casts this entire story in a very different light. If that proved to be true, it would also almost immediately, I'm no lawyer, but it would even probably move the heart of Judge Greer to wonder whether or not Michael could possibly be a fit guardian, in addition to all the things he's done subsequently.
I think it would. I really think Judge Greer would be very willing to say, this must be changed. I have not been impressed with Judge Greer. That's saying it mildly. But I do think, at the present time, we are where we are today. We can look back on the other things he has done and said, "Oh, it's been awful." But he has given this additional 2 days, and he has said that he's going to look into this. And I think, again, we should hope and pray that he will do so, and to, if people want to, even, you know, publicly make it clear that they appreciate what he is doing, and the fact that he is going to carefully look into this, because it's always easier to get people to open their hearts and their minds when others are supporting the opening of hearts and minds rather than lambasting for past mistakes.
And finally, very quickly, are 2 days, are 48 hours enough for the parents of Terry Schindler Schiavo legally to do what they need to do?
Well, sure. If in fact, because this is a chance to then argue this before Judge Greer and to persuade him that these other tests have to be done, that there has to be more follow-up on this. So there certainly is enough time. 2 hours can be enough time if you can persuade the judge then that these other avenues have to be pursued.
InternationalTaskForce.org is the website for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. Our guest, Rita Marker, is Executive Director of the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. Thank you very much for being our guest, Rita.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye.
Okay, we'll keep following that. I imagine probably Monday we'll be talking about it again as well. And it's worth talking about, and it's worth following. Another thing that's worth following is what's happening north of the border. You might be shocked at what you hear, but you're going to have to listen carefully. If you want to be shocked by this, if you want to hear the surprising comments that are made by Paul Martin, who is Prime Minister of Canada, he made these comments in the House of Commons there in Canada. You may or may not know that Canada, the House of Commons, is considering a bill that would enshrine in law what they call same-sex civil marriage. Now, I know that sounds like cobbling together of a lot of different things, and it is. Keep that term in mind as we listen here to Paul Martin, Prime Minister of Canada, and his comments in favor of a bill that would make it once and for all law and kind of official interpretation from the Supreme Court all the way to the legislature of the Canadian state that same-sex couples ought to be afforded, in the eyes of the government, and as we'll hear initially, not necessarily in the eyes of the church, but in the eyes of the government, the status of full marriage. They're not talking about same-sex civil unions. In fact, that idea is going to be, as you'll hear from Paul Martin, explicitly rejected as no solution at all. He calls it at one point, I don't know if we have that audio, separate but equal, which is not equal. So it's full marriage, a civil recognition of marriage. But as he addressed the House of Commons in support of this bill, Paul Martin, the Prime Minister of Canada, was quick to point out to those who had religious concerns about what the church might be required to do under this new law, that they need not worry.
This bill protects minority rights. This bill affirms the charter guarantee of religious freedom. It is that straightforward, Mr. Speaker, and it is that important. The Supreme Court has declared unanimously, and I quote, "The guarantee of religious freedom in Section 2A of the Charter is broad enough to protect religious officials from being compelled by the state to perform civil or religious same-sex marriages that are contrary to their religious beliefs." End of citation. The facts are plain, Mr. Speaker. Religious leaders who preside over marriage ceremonies must and will be guided by what they believe.
Now, for those of you who might have had a little trouble following that, what Paul Martin was saying there is those who are concerned that any church in Canada, any mosque, any synagogue would be required to perform same-sex marriages by the state in Canada need not worry. The same Supreme Court that had ruled, as we all know in Canada, that same-sex marriage ought to be the law of the land, also ruled that no one need perform a same-sex marriage ceremony in Canada against their religious beliefs. That's fine. That's good to hear. I'm glad to hear that the Canadian law will not require churches to do same-sex marriage. There is still two problems, by the way, there are still two problems that we need to deal with. One, there's still the hate speech codes in Canada that make it difficult for, while you can't, you don't have to do a same-sex marriage, you couldn't necessarily say that they shouldn't be done from your pulpit. To do that might be considered hate speech against a protected minority. So that's one other concern that still persists in Canada. We've talked with Canadian pastors about this on the program. The other concern is this. Just because churches will not be required to do same-sex ceremonies, there will be churches that will be encouraged to do same-sex ceremonies by the passage of such a law. Don't you think? I mean, that's a reasonable assumption, that there will be churches that have been sitting on the fence. Here you go, the legislature, the Supreme Court, everybody in Canada, all the way up to the Prime Minister say, same-sex marriage, good thing. The state recognizes it. Church might say, hey, if the state recognizes it, who are we to object? There's another concern, and that is this. Even if churches are not required to violate their policies, their beliefs, their creeds, and do same-sex marriages, that doesn't necessarily mean that the church should say, oh, okay, well, then I guess this doesn't concern us. Or that any individual Christian should say, well, I guess since it's not going to impinge on my religious freedom, I don't have to worry about it. It's just a state matter. So let's keep those concerns in mind as well. Paul Martin had more to say. He very boldly, very bravely, I use that word advisedly, I'll say boldly and rather blatantly addressed some of the critics of gay civil marriage. Here he is.
For most Canadians, in most parts of our country, same-sex marriage is already the law of the land. Thus, the issue is not whether rights are to be granted. The issue is that whether rights that have been granted are to be taken away. Now, some are frank and straightforward and say yes. Others have not been so candid. Despite being confronted with clear facts, despite being confronted with unanimous opinion of 134 legal scholars, experts in their field, intimately familiar with the Constitution, some have chosen to not be forthright with Canadians. They have eschewed the honest approach in favor of the political approach. They have attempted to cajole the public into believing that we can return to the past with a simple snap of the fingers, that we can revert to the traditional definition of marriage without consequence and without overriding the charter. They are insincere, they are disingenuous, and they are wrong.
He got a lot of applause when he was making these statements in front of the House of Commons. Paul Martin, the Prime Minister of Canada. Lots of applause. He also got some, I had to cut some heckling out of that particular, it just got a little too personal. There was some heckling. There were some interchanges with certain members of the House of Commons there. Did you hear his argument? Were you paying attention to what he actually said there? Let me lay it out for you. His argument is this. And I heard him make it in the course of his, he had about a 20-minute address here to the House of Commons. I'm only bringing you excerpts of it. I heard him make this argument on at least four separate occasions in the course of 20 minutes. It was, you might say, the theme of his statement. Same-sex marriage is already the law of the land in Canada in many, most places. Therefore, to deny this bill, it's actually called the Civil Marriage Act in Canada, in the House of Commons, to deny this bill that would allow marriage, full-blown same-sex marriage in Canada, recognized and sanctioned by the state, would be to take away rights that people have. This is a bold argument. You say, well, what's so bold about it? He has effectively turned the tables. Rather than saying what we're talking about is recognizing a right that gay people ought to have or granting a right that same-sex couples ought to have, it's a very clever political maneuver. He said, look, most of the provinces already allow gay marriage, ergo it's the law of the land. To not pass this bill would be to take away fundamental human rights. Do you notice the real cleverness of this argument is that the question is no longer whether or not gay marriage should occur. It already does, he says. Therefore, since it does, it should be recognized as a fundamental right, and to do anything other than that is to deny someone their rights. Where did he learn this argument? He might have learned it by listening to the advocates for gay marriage here in the United States, or maybe they learned it by listening to him. He has framed the debate in such a way to depict the critics of gay marriage in Canada as those who want to, number one, violate, sometimes they call, they, he refers to the Charter and also the Constitution, to violate their Constitution and basically the Canadian Bill of Rights. People who don't want gay marriage are against the Constitution. Contrast that with the argument that we're having down here south of the border, where at least at this point in the public debate, it is still acknowledged because we don't have same-sex marriage, except in one state. It's still acknowledged that this is an innovation. He actually argued at one point in his comments to the House of Commons that this is precisely what the founders of the Canadian state envisioned. They explicitly envisioned same-sex marriage. And to deny it would be to violate their intent. What a difference a couple hundred miles makes. What a difference a little line on the map makes. Or so it seems. When we come back from this break, more open lines for your questions and your comments. Oh, by the way, we play this so that, not so that we could jeer at our northern neighbors, but so that we might get an idea of where the debate in our own circles is probably headed. We'll hear more from Paul Martin after this.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Issues, Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called our Issues, Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues, Etc., and this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, here are the three levels of giving. The confessor, $25 monthly or an annual gift of $250. The apologist, $50 monthly or an annual gift of $500. And the reformer, $100 monthly or an annual gift of $1,000. Now, each Reformation Club member receives premiums like monthly tapes, books, and transcripts. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club today by making a tax-deductible gift payable to Issues Etc. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Help us reach our goal of 125 Issues Etc. Reformation Club members by Easter. Issues Etc. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117.
The universe. The Big Bang can't explain it.
Answers with Ken Ham.
whose ministry is building a planetarium near Cincinnati, Ohio. Well, Ken, I thought the Big Bang was supposed to explain how the universe formed, but now you've got me curious because now you're saying it can't explain it.
Well, most evolutionists believe that the Big Bang occurred 13.7 billion years ago. So how big would we expect the universe to be? Well, even if the universe expanded at the speed of light, the distance across it should be 27.4 billion light years, right? Wrong. From new data collected from a space probe examining what's called cosmic background radiation, astronomers estimate the universe is at least 156 billion light years wide. Now, the only way the secular scientists can explain this is to apply a fudge factor to their calculations and accept that the universe must have expanded much faster than the speed of light. It's no wonder that 33 leading secular scientists have published an open letter to the scientific community rejecting the Big Bang. You know, sadly, many Christian leaders have accepted the Big Bang and reinterpreted God's word to make it fit with this secular idea. What will they have to do when the Big Bang falls out of favor with the secular world, as it's now beginning to do? They'll have to reinterpret their reinterpretation of the Bible. You know, what another lesson as to why Christians can't compromise on the Word of God.
You can read many of Ken Ham's free booklets on our popular website, AnswersRadio.com. That's AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. For many people today, censorship has become a bad word. Directors, actors, and legal scholars continue to debate the finer points of artistic freedom and government censorship. But what do Christian parents do in the meantime? Regardless of where you stand on this issue on the national level, for Christian parents, censorship must be practiced in the home. The music our children hear, the video games they play, and the movies they watch can encourage drug abuse, sexual immorality, and even suicide. Jesus loves our children very much, enough to die on the cross for them. He does not want them to engage in any self-destructive behavior. It is our God-given responsibility as parents to protect our children from harm. So when it comes to censorship in the home, there is no debate. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part locally by Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, Illinois. Christ Our Savior is located at 612 North State Street in Freeburg. The Reverend Bruce Kaseman is the pastor. Their phone number, area code 618-539-5664. Christ Our Savior Lutheran Church in Freeburg, an Issues Etc. underwriter on AM 850 KFUO. All right, I'm back. We were discussing whether or not Craig was going to get a break here before we went on with the rest of the program. No, Craig. Stay seated, please. I need you. I need your fingers on the buttons there. It's Open Lines Issues, Etc. Here in the last 25 minutes, our call-in numbers are 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're in the course of hearing from Paul Martin, who is Prime Minister of Canada, making an address at the House of Commons recently. C-SPAN carried it live. Now, it's not all of his comments. Part of the problem is Paul Martin does a very peculiar thing. Maybe I'm just not a Canadian, so I don't understand what they do. But he speaks two paragraphs in English, and then he switches to French. And then he does that for two paragraphs, and then he switches back to English. He doesn't translate himself. He just switches back and forth between French and English. Because, of course, in Canada, lots of French people, or French-speaking Canadians, I should say. So some of the juiciest stuff he had to say was actually said in a woman's voice, which I thought might confuse our listeners. It was a translator. So we just got Paul Martin here. What is he doing? He's making the case for the Civil Marriage Act in Canada and the House of Commons. And his argument has been laid very carefully. One, don't worry, religious people, because we're not going to try and make you do same-sex marriages. Number two, everyone who opposes this, for whatever reason, is guilty of trying to take away rights granted explicitly by the Canadian Constitution, in particular, what they call, their Bill of Rights, the equivalent of our first 10 amendments to the Constitution. So it's not the argument that we hear here in the United States, which is, well, Obviously, the Constitution would never have countenanced something like gay marriage, but since it's a living document and has to continue to progress, it could now, according to modern interpretations, permit something like same-sex marriage. No, he says the founders of the Canadian state envisioned this kind of broad reading of the document to include same-sex marriage. Now, he's also got a third plank to his argument, which is the critics of same-sex marriage in Canada are proposing an impossibility. What's the impossibility? You can't go back. We've already been doing gay marriage. We can't go back. We can't go back to the traditional marriage. Why? Because now this is kind of the living document argument of the Constitution. Since the document is always evolving in its interpretation, to go back would be to rob people of rights that we recently discovered. This is precisely. Now, where does that sound familiar? Why does it sound so familiar to us down here on the South Side? Well, because it's precisely the argument made by the pro-choice community with regard to Roe v. Wade. The Roe Court found a new right. They actually found the shadow of a new right, but that was good enough. And so, in finding the shadow of a new right to privacy for pregnant women, they were able to say, hey, the Constitution has moved on. And if we deny women the right to choose without restriction from beginning of end to pregnancy to abort their children, we're robbing them of a right that the Constitution gives them. A perfect parallel with Paul Martin's argument for passing the Civil Marriage Act. He says it comes down to a very, very simple choice. A very simple choice for Canadian lawmakers and a very simple choice for the Canadian people and anyone who's concerned about it. We'll get to his choice here in just a minute and his answer to that choice. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines, issues, etc. Give me your thoughts on the issue of gay marriage in Canada. Is it relevant? I mean, much of what Canada does is irrelevant. It's kind of literally the meringue on the top of the lemon cream pie of the United States, for the most part. As most Americans don't think about what happens in Canada. You might visit there if you want to hunt grizzly bears, but golly, does it make any difference to you? And I know we have some listeners in Canada for which it does make a difference. What do you think? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Calling from his car, Dick is on the line.
Actually, it's Derek.
Oh, Derek.
That's all right.
That's fine.
Especially relevant this year now that there's no hockey. the one observation I would make is that Paul Martin seems to believe that it is a right for same-sex couples to marry because the government has made it so, and not because it was a right that was endowed to people by their creator.
You're absolutely, I think you have hit the nail on the head right there, Derek, because, well, actually, there is no reference in his long address to any rights devolving from the Creator. If I'm not mistaken, and I could be wrong, I don't think that the Canadian Constitution parallels the U.S. Constitution in that respect. And what difference does that make? Well, it makes a lot of difference. If there's no Creator anchoring the rights, if the Constitution of a state is a document that can evolve in its interpretation over time, and if it is the government that grants the rights through its varying interpretation of the Constitution as a document, then what he believes, Paul Martin, or what he appears to believe, makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Of course we can grant rights, because this is how rights come to us, from the government. And since the government is ruled by the Constitution is a malleable, changeable, ever-progressing, evolving document, new rights, of course, naturally can be found. You folks listening in Canada, let me know what you think about this issue. Is this how your Constitution should work? Is this how it does work? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, calling from his car. Scott is on the line. Scott, welcome.
Hi, Todd. How you doing?
Doing well.
Hey, I'm going to try to attempt to answer your question about if it makes a difference on this issue, what Canada does, and I guess I'll use the paradigm that I saw used when the prescription drug debate where I think the Canadian system and their practices were held up, especially, you know, by the more left-leaning folks in the political realm as the ideal. So I fully anticipate that if Canada goes the way they look like they're going, that the that those people on that side will hold them up and say, hey, look, you just they've got it right on prescription drugs. They've got it right on this. So that's my comment.
All right. Thank you, Scott. Well, certainly there is. We entered a period in American cultural history and political history where our mantra has become, you know, we could learn a lot from the blank. Learn a lot from the Muslims. We could learn a lot from those Canadians. We could learn a lot from the French. We could learn a lot from the Germans. We could learn a lot from the Swedish. Kind of the argument that is enshrined in this latest debate, inter-judge debate in the U.S. Supreme Court between Scalia and others on the U.S. Supreme Court about should we watch what's going on in other countries and their law? Should their law serve as precedent for our decisions? So that shouldn't surprise us that people are looking north of the border and saying, hey, they're right on so many things, healthcare and gay marriage. I think, though, the influence as it will play out here in the United States might just be a little more crude than that, a little more rough edge than that. And that is the activists who want to see gay marriage expand beyond the state of Massachusetts in the United States will take their cue, will take their lead from how it's been introduced in Canada. And that is, you've got 10 provinces across the broad expanse of Canada, and most of them now have legalized gay marriage. It has laid the foundation for, hey, everybody's doing it. Every province practically allows this to occur. So to not do it federally at the level of the federal government would be to deny people rights they already have, which is Paul Martin's argument. So what can we expect if the activists in the United States decide to follow that lead? Well, they've already established a beachhead. It's called the state of Massachusetts. Their beachhead is, in that state, there is full-blown gay marriage. Vermont may be the next to follow. Who knows? Because Vermont has civil unions. You know, a lot of states are going to opt for no gay marriage but civil unions. Look at those constitutional amendments that we were talking about in November, state by state by state. A lot of them say no gay marriage but civil unions. That, by the way, is the stated position of our president. No gay marriage but civil unions. We'll let the lawyers figure it out. No gay marriage but civil unions. Now, if you believe that there's no light between gay marriage and civil unions, if you get what? 30 states that have no gay marriage but civil unions in their constitution as amendments? And, of course, President Bush does say that each state should decide on the whole issue of civil unions. If you get 30 states, someone will stand up and say, like Paul Martin is doing right now in Canada, most of our states already have the equivalent of gay marriage. What we need to do is not deny those people their rights by taking it away at the federal level. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Paul Martin, Prime Minister of Canada, speaking to the issue of civil marriage, the Civil Marriage Act in the House of Commons, says it comes down to a simple decision, yes or no.
Will you use the notwithstanding clause to overturn the definition of civil marriage and deny Canadians a right that is guaranteed under the Charter? This question does not demand rhetoric. It demands clarity. There are only two legitimate answers, yes or no. Not the demagoguery we have heard, not the dodging, not the flawed reasoning, not the false options, simply yes or no.
This is culture shock. I mean, I know I could get there in 4 hours on an airplane, but this is culture shock. He's combative. He is taking the ball to his opponents on this issue and saying, all right, you guys, forget the demagoguery, forget the rhetoric. Yes or no, are you going to take rights away from the Canadian people? Are you going to use a clause of the Constitution? It's called the notwithstanding clause. Are you going to use that to deny the Charter, which is their Bill of Rights? It's equivalent to a U.S. president standing up, or say, Speaker of the House or something like that, standing up and saying, at some future point in the United States, will you deny homosexual couples their innate God-given right to marry and go against the Constitution? Yes or no? No one is brave enough to say that at this point in any of our, well, some of them are foolish enough to say it, but no one's brave enough to go with the kind of fervor that Paul Martin is now in the House of Commons. This isn't a guy who thinks he's going to lose the debate. This is a guy who thinks he has, probably does, have the opponents of gay marriage, at least among the lawmakers, on the ropes. And he's just there administering the last few punches. And the last one's going to be a KO. And he's pretty sure that he can time the round to watch his opponent fall whenever he wants to. If you put, well, those are boxing terms. The fight's over. Yeah, do they still have to vote on it? Sure. But as far as Paul Martin's concerned, the fight is over. And he posed the question, will you take away the rights of this minority of same-sex couples that they already have, he says, he asserts? No decision needs to be made except, will you take away their rights? He says he has an answer for that question, too.
Will you take away a right that is guaranteed under the Charter? I, for one, will answer that question, Mr. Speaker, and I will answer it clearly. I will say no.
Keep your eyes open. Keep your ears open. It may not be today. It may not be tomorrow, but it will be someday, and it will be soon. That those very arguments will be heard from American lawmakers, American elected officials. Make no mistake about it, those who want to see gay marriage in the United States enshrined in our law are ready to go to the end of every single round. We were talking some time back with Dr. David Adams. He said, I wonder if you agree with this. He said the gay marriage debate, in terms of the culture war, and in terms of the legal battling and haranguing that's going to take place in the United States, is going to make 32 years of Roe v. Wade and the debate over abortion look like a tea party. It will outstrip it. And I asked, why? And he said, because they're not going to give up. Because they are willing to go to whatever steps are necessary, the activists who want gay marriage, to see that it happens. And they think they can win. Let's hear from you. If you were debating Prime Minister Paul Martin there in the House of Commons, someone tried, and Paul Martin knows how to deal with his hecklers. I tell you what, he put them down. But if you were there in debate in this open forum on this issue, and he has made the case he's already made here, how would you respond? And I ask the question for this reason. We're going to have to respond to it ourselves, because this is exactly the argument that's going to be made sooner or later here in the United States. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Granted, there are differences between our system and theirs. There are differences between our Constitution and theirs. But sooner or later, we will have to respond to these arguments. So let's get busy now thinking of how we might respond. I want to hear your response to Paul Martin's arguments in the House of Commons. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You know the kicker on his argument? And this is the one you really have to be able to answer, because it's subtle, it sounds good, it sounds progressive, it sounds like we're moving ahead. The kicker on his argument is the last point, and I only mentioned it in passing. We can't go back. It's almost an argument that could be made by someone who says, you know, I don't have a dog in this race. I'm not in favor of gay marriage. I'm not against gay marriage. It's an argument that could almost be made like the likes of Bill O'Reilly, who says, I don't care if they get married or they don't get married. Doesn't make any difference to me. Let them marry. Fine. I have no axe to grind. You know, the argument we can't go back is an argument that can be made from a position of supposed, alleged neutrality on this issue. Well, whatever you think about gay marriage, we can't go back. We can't turn back the clock. We can't go back to Ozzie and Harriet and the traditional definition of marriage. Too much has changed. It would require undoing too many things. You ask, you say, wow, that something sounds familiar about that argument. Where did I hear that one before? Well, if you're not paying attention, you might not have noticed that that's the precise argument that's being made in the church for decades now. Decades. Oh, there was nothing wrong with the way the church we used to believe. There's nothing wrong with the way we used to practice. There was nothing wrong with what we used to do on Sunday morning when we did it. But too much has changed and we can't go back. To return to the historic liturgy, to the ancient Christian creeds, the ancient Christian hymnody, to go back to that would be turning the clock back. And we can't do that. It's a subtle and powerful and innately deceptive argument. We were talking earlier with Pastor Will Whedon about faithfulness. Since I'm on the subject of the church for a moment here, allow me to digress. Faithfulness. I had a conversation with the pastor this morning, and we were talking about faithfulness. And one of us said, I don't remember if it was him or me, said, we were talking about how difficult it is to be faithful. And I was driving away thinking, you know, if it weren't difficult to be faithful, then I don't think they'd call it faithfulness. Part of the definition of faithfulness to God's word is that it's hard. God never makes it easy to be faithful. Jesus says there's a way that seems right to a man, or actually Proverbs says there's a way that seems right to a man. Well, Jesus, he's the author of that too. The way that seems right to a man, but that way leads to death. It seems right, it seems easy, it seems to make sense. But it's the way that leads to death. It's usually the path of least resistance, by the way. Could you turn it around to a corollary? There's a way that seems wrong to a man, but this is the way that leads to life. There's a way that you don't want to go that you'd rather not do. You know, being faithful to God's word is hard. And those who say in the church are making the Paul Martin argument in the church, who say, well, we can't go back. I know that we should be faithful, that we were faithful, but too much has changed. We can't go back. Times have changed. And to go back would be to regress, devolve, give up all of our gains, are really making a very subtle yet deceptive argument against being faithful. They might even follow up with another kind of Paul Martin-esque argument, which is, we're still being faithful. We're still being faithful. We're just doing it in a different way. There's one way to be faithful. One way, because there's one truth. If there were multiple truths that could all coexist together, then one might say you could find more than one way to be faithful. This is why Jesus also says that way that leads to life, it's narrow and difficult, and few go upon it. The way that leads to death, it's wide. All your friends are going that way too. So lo and behold, and it really shouldn't surprise us, that the arguments being made in the culture, be it Canadian or American, for things like gay marriage, are very similar to the arguments being made in the church. Why shouldn't it surprise us? Well, we talk about this a lot on the program. The church has, for some reason, in the last several decades, decided that aping the culture is what it's all about. So we shouldn't be surprised to find the culture's arguments against being faithful to things like the Constitution or the traditional definition of marriage finding their way into the church, aping the culture, against being faithful in all sorts of more serious and more profound ways. Think about how often Jesus himself talks about being faithful, faithful stewards, faithful servants. Well done, thou good and faithful servant, faithful in a little, faithful in a lot. Jesus was kind of hung up on faithfulness. He was a stickler for faithfulness. And he didn't have a broad fluid elastic definition of the thing either, nor did his apostles. Which is why all but one of them ends up dead as a martyr. Because faithfulness, sometimes he says, be thou faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. And he doesn't say that because, it might come to death, or it might get difficult for you if you're going to be faithful. He can pretty much guarantee it will. It's what he means when he says, if anyone wants to come after me, then they'll have to go the way I go. My faithfulness means a life of opposition leading all the way to the cross. My faithfulness means a cross, says Jesus. And so will yours. Issues, etc. is underwritten in part by Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. They know a lot about faithfulness up there, don't they? At least they try. This summer in Fort Wayne, Indiana, they are going to have Christ Academy 2005. It's the beginning of a way of planting a seed in someone, a young man that you might know in your congregation, in your family, or maybe your pastor knows of one, ask him, who's interested in the life of faithfulness. He actually thinks it might be a good idea to put his hand to the plow and not look back, or to take up his cross and follow Jesus and be faithful unto death. He wants to be a pastor, a faithful pastor. Encourage him in doing that. One of the ways of encouraging him to do that, Christ Academy 2005, a two-week residential program for high school-aged men there on Concordia Theological Seminary's campus this summer. For more information, our website address, issuesetc.org. We have the logo there and a link to more information. All your questions will be answered. Or you can call them toll-free, 1-800-481-2155, Christ Academy 2005 at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, 1-800-481-2155. Tomorrow on the program, if you want to hear Dr. Martin Nolan's answer to the question, when he does finally die, will Pope John Paul II be in heaven? Tune in tomorrow. We'll not only be talking about that, but the office of the papacy and making that clear distinction between the man and the office. Dr. Martin Nolan of the Concordia Historical Institute, also the conclusion of our four-part series on the Book of Joshua, based on our Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Joshua, with its author, Dr. Adolf Harstad. We'll be talking about how God's victories with the armies of Israel laid the foundation for him keeping a greater promise of his covenant. We'll also talk about the emerging church movement with Shane Rosenthal of the White Horse Inn. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.